What tool Joseph uses to help him translate the Book of Mormon isn't a very big deal just by itself. But what it means for us as followers of Christ is a big deal. Because if Joseph was a lying fraud, that matters. If Joseph was deceived by the devil, that matters too. And if Joseph was truly a prophet of God, called to restore the fullness of the gospel of Christ to the earth, then that matters most of all. That's the real question here. Hey guys, so in our last episode, we talked about how everybody views the seer stone ideas. We talked about different theories that people have and different points of view. So what kind of questions do we want to cover in this podcast?
Well, if we're going to take the idea of a seer stone seriously at all, there has to be a rational way to understand what is going on. It sounds crazy, but there's got to be a rational, a lot of really smart people believe in it, but believe this is really how the history happened. So I would be curious, like, what led up to this?
Well, I imagine for you coming into this, it was very strange hearing about that for the first time, right?
Yeah, if you hear about it in primary for the first time, it might not sound strange as an adult. But an adult joining the church is going to be like, this doesn't make sense. And so I'd be curious, like, how do the really smart people understand this?
I'm looking at a little bit more for like a historic. If I wanted to put myself in Joseph's shoes, for example, if we're looking at this from a historical perspective, I would like to know how Joseph, as he's translating the Book of Mormon, wants to or is viewing the idea of seer stones, because I think there are a lot of differing opinions as to kind of how seer stones were viewed way back then, and there's I guess I'm looking at it from how does Joseph see it. Not necessarily just how we can see it, although that's important. We need to be able to think about this sort of thing.
It speaks to his motivation. Was he just trying to be a con man? Was there actual real religious intent behind this?
And I think for me, the big questions are, did that come from God? Mm-hmm. Or was Joseph lying? Or was he deceived by Satan?
Do we have anything in the scriptural record, even before Joseph Smith, that shows God kind of working in ways that seem real weird on the surface?
Yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I have heard over the years of stories of glowing stones that prophets have had. Mm-hmm. So what were they?
You know, the story of... like, take the Red Sea, the crossing of the Red Sea. It's like they cross on dry ground. Even if you split the waters, the ground, like, it does not make sense to our scientific minds. They lived in such a radically different culture and time. Like, how did people in biblical days understand how God worked with the earth elements?
That's a great question. You look very pleased with yourself.
No, just ignore me. I'm not doing anything important. I'm just looking forward to seeing what you have in store is all.
All right. Well, I guess we need to start answering some questions.
Yeah, let's jump in.
Okay. When you first look at the question of whether or not Joseph Smith used the Nephite interpreters for the entire Book of Mormon translation, or whether he also used a personal seer stone, a ton of questions come up. The biggest question in my mind is, would God ever approve of Joseph using his own seer stone for the translation? And if so, why? He already had the interpreters, right? They were prepared specifically for the translation of ancient records. So why not just use those for the entire translation? And the idea of Joseph being a village seer before being called as a prophet is just weird in our day and age. In our culture, that's not something we believe in. Latter-day Saints of my age grew up hearing that things like Ouija boards and face cards and astrology are tools used by Satan to deceive people, and that are spiritually dangerous. Even today, our prophets and apostles warn against things like energy healing or using crystals. So things like using a seer stone to find lost objects or a divining rod to find water is totally foreign to me. But Joseph didn't grow up in our culture, and maybe God didn't consider his being a local seer to be a bad thing. I mean, God works in mysterious ways, right? So maybe he wanted to use something that Joseph was familiar with to help make it easier for him. So we really need to boil this question down to the basics. Why would God ever use something like a seer stone in the first place? Has he used seer stones or other objects in the past to help prophets channel revelation or priesthood power? And is Joseph's seer stone a legitimate tool sanctioned by God, or is it evil? Those are the questions that I set out to answer in this episode. when I have gospel questions, the first place I turn to is Heavenly Father. So I started this project with a prayer. Then I pulled out my scriptures and went to work on answering the first two questions. The first question that I looked at is, why would God ever use something like a seer stone? There are two scriptures that came to mind, and they are the ones that often come up when you see this question asked online. The first is in the Book of Mormon in 2 Nephi 31:3. The second verse that people often cite is in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 124. Both of these scriptures say that God speaks to us in our language according to our understanding. He speaks to us in ways that make sense to us so that we can better hear and understand what he's telling us. I've compared this before on a very basic level to memes, because memes are visual callbacks to something that we're already familiar with. So when we see them and the new twist that someone puts on them, we immediately get the original reference, which helps us understand what the creator is trying to say. The Lord obviously doesn't use memes to communicate with us, but he does communicate with us in familiar ways to help us understand what he's trying to teach us. So if Joseph Smith was comfortable using a seer stone, would the Lord have used that as a way to teach him about receiving revelation? To me, considering those verses, the answer is, yeah, maybe. Way back in the 80s, after the Salamander letter was proven to be a forgery, President Oaks gave a talk called Recent Events Evolving Church History and Forged Documents. In that talk, he says,
it should be recognized that such tools as the Urim and Thummim, the Liahona, seer stones, and other articles have been used appropriately in biblical, Book of Mormon, and modern times by those who have the gift and authority to obtain revelation from God in connection with their use. At the same time, scriptural accounts and personal experience show that unauthorized, though perhaps well-meaning persons, have made inappropriate use of tangible objects while seeking or claiming to receive spiritual guidance. Those who define folk magic to include any use of tangible objects to aid in obtaining spiritual guidance confound the real with the counterfeit. They mislead themselves and their readers.
This, I think, is the key. God does sometimes use physical objects as a way to help us receive revelation or to channel priesthood power. But when it's not sanctioned by God and it's not a spiritual gift given to someone with the authority to use it, it's not okay. That's when it becomes wrong and dangerous and a tool of the adversary to lead us astray. So once I answered that question, the next question in my mind was, what other examples from the scriptures do we have of the Lord using physical objects like this? I went looking for them and I found a bunch of them. Genesis 44:2-5 talks about Joseph of Egypt's divining cup. David Snell from Saints Unscripted is here to tell us more.
But today I really wanted to talk about some ancient Jewish extra-biblical mysticism about the story of a glowing stone or jewel called in Hebrew a Sohar. You might remember we talked about this in a recent episode as it applied to Noah's Ark, so check that out if you haven't. But to learn more about this legend, we're going to tap into a book by non-Latter-day Saint author Howard Schwartz. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying this legend is true. It may be fact, fiction, or a mixture of both. I just think the connections we can draw from it are pretty cool. So, according to the legend, the original Sohar was a glowing jewel that Adam received from an angel when he and Eve left the Garden of Eden, which was passed down from generation to generation. Eventually, Enoch inherits it. And check this out. Enoch peered deeply into the jewel and saw that the flame burning in it formed itself into Hebrew letters. And by reading those letters, he was able to read the celestial Torah, which was imprinted in the flame of that glowing jewel. Eventually, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob inherit the stone. Jacob gives it to his son Joseph.
The miracle child.
Now, when Jacob gave it to Joseph, the stone was dark, and Jacob did not reveal its power, for he wanted Joseph to discover this for himself. And because Joseph's brothers did not know how precious the stone was, they did not take it from Joseph when they stripped him of the coat of many colors and cast him into the dark pit. As legend has it, this dark pit was a well, and in the darkness, light came from the stone. Eventually, Joseph is found by Midianites and sold into Egypt. At some point, Joseph obtains his divining cup, which we referenced earlier in this video, and as the story goes, Joseph placed the glowing stone of the Sohar inside his silver cup and discovered that by peering into it, he could read the future and interpret dreams. That is how he interpreted the dreams of the butler and baker and later the dreams of Pharaoh that prophesied the 7 years of famine. It was that same cup that Joseph hid in the saddlebags of Benjamin, about which his servant said, "Is this not the cup from which our master drinketh and with which he divineth?"
In Genesis 30:37-43, Jacob of Israel had a rod of poplars, or a branch, that he used to help selectively breed stronger sheep that multiplied in numbers more quickly than flocks of his father-in-law. He peeled strips off the bark, and when he put the stripped wood down near the breeding area, the lambs who were bred would be born with certain colors and patterns, indicating how strong they were. He was able to use this method to increase his wealth and eventually, you know, leave his father-in-law's house because he got duped multiple times.
Yes. All through the book of Exodus, Moses and Aaron used their staffs to perform miracles, like when Aaron did battle with the Pharaoh's priests, or when Moses separated the Red Sea or struck the rock to produce water.
In Judges chapter 13-16, it tells the story of Samson, who was incredibly strong. In chapter 16, it's revealed that his source of strength is tied to his hair. He followed the laws of God by not cutting his hair, and he was strong. But when he sinned with Delilah and allowed her to cut off his hair, the spirit left him, and he became weak. In this case, his hair was a symbol of the commitment to God and his devotion to keeping the commandments.
Things got hairy.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm sorry. No, I'm done. I promise I'm done.
I do not believe you.
Don't make promises you cannot keep.
Okay, you're right. You're right. Honest in all my dealings. It's just come kind of my double record.
Honest in all your dealings, please. I will make more bad jokes.
In Exodus 28, verses 6 through 12, it describes something called an ephod, which was made of a colored yarn and differently colored gemstones on it. And this was actually something like an apron that they wore in the temple, and I'll just leave that there without elaborating. Verses 15 through 13 describe the breastplate that went over the apron and how the original Urim and Thummim were placed into the breastplate. And these garments allowed the priests to receive revelation. This Urim and Thummim was what the Nephite interpreters and possibly Joseph's personal seer stone were named after by the early saints.
Exodus 25:10-22 describes the Ark of the Covenant. Anyone who's ever seen the first Indiana Jones movie should be familiar with this object and what it could do. When the Israelites marched with the Ark at their head, they were unbeatable in battle.
And in Exodus 3:1-4 is Moses' encounter with the burning bush, when he speaks with Jehovah and receives personal revelation to direct his movements.
In Numbers 21:8-9, we have the story of the brass serpent, which is an object placed on a staff. And if the dying Israelites would look at the staff because they were being bitten by venomous serpents in that time, if they looked at the brass serpent, they would live. And when they, or if they didn't, they would die.
Daniel 5:5-29, it tells a very cool story of King Belshazzar seeing the finger of God writing on the temple wall, and none of his soothsayers could interpret it. So he brought in Daniel to read it for him. This is highly reminiscent of the brother of Jared seeing the hand of God, Joseph of Egypt interpreting the king's dreams when no one else could, and Joseph Smith interpreting writing through revelation.
And these stories aren't just in the Old Testament. James chapter 5 speaks of consecrated oil, which we still use today to anoint the heads of those receiving blessings of healing.
Acts 1:26 talks about the apostles casting lots when they needed to fill the vacancy found in the quorum of the 12, and they put little sticks in a cup and they emptied it on the ground, and allegedly God was directing the outcome. And so they were able to pick who the next apostle would be based on this, these physical objects.
There are also descriptions of the Savior doing this. John 9:1-9 tells the story of a blind man who was cured when Christ put mud on his eyes. And Mark 5:35-43 talks of Jesus raising Jairus' daughter from the dead by saying, Talitha kumi. Those words were very similar to a magic spell of the day, showing that the true power was in Christ, not the incantation.
Revelation 2:17 speaks of white stones bearing the owner's new name that no one else knows. Doctrine and Covenants 130:10 clarifies that these are the Urim and Thummims that everyone in the celestial kingdom will have.
In the Book of Mormon, in 1 Nephi 16:26-29, we have the description of the Lehona. And this obviously worked through the faith of its followers, guiding them across the sea, across the wilderness. And it was well in use well after that, depending on what scholars he listened to, like Don Bradley.
Ether 3:4 speaks of the glowing stones the Lord touched so that the Jaredites could see during their sea voyage.
And of course, Mosiah 8:13 and Ether 3:24-25 describe the interpreters, two translucent white stones set in a bow-like spectacles that fasten to a breastplate, allowing the wearer to see visions and translate ancient records.
Doctrine and Covenants 8, verses 6 through 9, talks about Oliver Cowdery's divining rod. And hopefully we'll get Jennifer being able to discuss that more detail in a more detailed manner, I should say, in the next episode. So that'll be fun.
And lastly, Abraham 3:1-2 mentions that Abraham has a Urim and Thummim of his own. This gets tricky, though, because it's not the Urim and Thummim in the Old Testament, and it's not the Nephite interpreters or even the white stones from Revelation. So what is it? Are there stories about Abraham or other prophets that aren't in the Bible that might shed some light on this? To answer those questions, I turned to Alan Hansen.
So, first of all, Alan,
yeah.
Can you explain what the rabbinical literature is and extra-biblical Jewish traditions are, where they came from?
Sure. So just a real quick recap. The main books that you have after the end of the Bible, the end of the Second Temple era, with the rabbinic tradition, you have the written Torah, which is the scriptures, especially the five books of Moses, and then you have the oral traditions, which pretty much is everything else. And in the second century AD, they start to write down and codify some of the laws and a little bit more in depth in how you're supposed to observe things. Now, after that, that's called the Mishnah, and after that was written, you then have, and this is a process that took centuries and happened in land of Israel and in Babylon at the same time, but you end up with something called the Talmud, which is basically a stylized literary representation of how they discuss things in the academies. And these can be pretty freewheeling. They wander off a lot from the main topic that they, with the Mishnah they were talking about. And alongside with this, the Talmuds contain several, and there's independent collections. There's something called Midrash, which is basically different stories and explanations about the scriptures. A lot of these incorporate earlier traditions. We have some that are definitely can be dated back to the Bible that carry on all the way into the modern era in different guises. But the main factor here is that the rabbinic sages were very close readers of the Bible. They were attuned to repetitions, doublets, different grammar things. And when they noticed something odd, they thought that there's going to be something more about it. They went into it. But a lot of the traditions predate these. They preserve a lot of earlier stuff from, and it's hard to tell sometimes when one begins, one ends.
Okay, that is so fascinating. So how does that tie in to seer stones?
All right. So this is something where we need to go back a little bit further before the rabbinic era. You know, in the Bible, we're all familiar with the general, the two creation accounts. But there's other things in the Psalms and Isaiah sometimes, hints of other creation stories, such as a creation by light. One of the big things is, in Genesis, God says, let there be light. But this is before the sun and the moon and the stars. So they were thinking that this must have been God's divine light, the primordial light by which he created. In the Psalms, it says, wraps himself with a mantle of light. Mm-hmm. And
Speaking about that, yeah. I have heard there is some kind of a tradition about Adam and Eve being clothed in garments of light as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and there are different things. Light is basically the material that God's made from and sustains the universe with. So there's a lot into that. But we know, as far as the earliest Greek commentators in scripture that we have several centuries BC, we know they talk about the light also. So Aristobulus wrote that the first day, the one in which light was born, by which all things are seen together. Okay. And this is the biggest part than what connects to the seer stones. So this tradition is very strong, and it's present in most every text has something to do with this. But the idea was that this light was so powerful that Adam, and some scholars even say you can read it just as all men in this case, could see from one end of the earth to the other, one end of the world to the other.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
Yeah, you could see all things with it. And God saw that the wicked in the generation of Noah and others would abuse that. So he decided to hide that light. Okay. Once Adam was expelled from the garden, he decided to hide the light. And when he did, there's some really interesting traditions about where he hides it. Sometimes it's in the rocks, sometimes it's in the ground, things that let things grow. Mm-hmm. And he also was supposed to have hidden it in his scriptures.
Oh.
So okay. These are two things, the rocks and the scriptures, that are big vessels for divine light.
All right. So I think that ties in a little bit with one of the stories that we wanted to talk about Adam and the angel Raziel.
Yeah.
So can you just give us, first of all, just an overview of what that story is and how that light ties into that?
Oh, yeah. So we have this angel who's called Raziel, which means the secrets or mysteries of God. And he appears in several old sources. And the idea is he's the keeper of the secret information. And when Adam, before he was expelled from the garden, had a book that he could read in, according to some traditions. They interpret the verse, "These are the generations of Adam," as meaning this was a book that he could see
what
was in it from beginning of the world to the end. And the book was full of light, and it was connected to the tree of knowledge.
Okay.
Then when he's expelled from the garden, and he starts to weep, and many of the traditions, I'm just giving the general because there's several of them, but the main line is that he's weeping and despairing because he doesn't have that knowledge, that connection anymore. So God restores it to him through the angel Raziel.
Okay. How does he restore it to him?
Sometimes he just shows up and gives him a book. Okay. Now, this story carries on to talk about Noah. And the wording is not entirely clear, whether it's the angel showing up and giving it to Noah brand new or if it was handed down. There's a little bit traditions back and forth, and some other traditions have the book being given to Seth. Mm-hmm. But the really interesting thing is Noah gets it, and it tells him how to build the ark.
Oh, okay.
And he builds this box of gold that he puts it in. And then he knows, he uses it to tell when it's daytime, when it's nighttime, when he can feed the animals and all the other wisdom. But the really interesting thing about this book, and this is a tradition in the reconstructed Book of Secrets or Sefer Azim, which is a whole bunch of lists of how you use angels to do what you want. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that this book was engraved on a stone.
Oh.
So it's both a glowing stone and a book at the same time.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And it implies that it glows also when he knows when it's day and night and being able to see from it. So that's the implication. So you have this book in a gold box that's a book made out of a stone. And the stone is a sapphire stone, which has a lot of cosmic significance. And Rabbi Bacha, in Spanish exegete in the 13th century, wrote in his commentary that blue is a very humble spiritual color, because it's not bold like red or anything. Mm-hmm. So the light there is also light of wisdom. And it's a light that shines and is equal to the light that shines from the scriptures.
Oh, that's really fascinating, actually. Yeah. That's very interesting.
And it was also connected with being able to, in Middle Ages, being able to heal eye ailments and bad eyesight. They'd pass it over.
Okay.
So he uses that also to explain that it's equivalent to being healed spiritually by scriptures. It's symbolizing that.
So are there other stories through all of these Jewish traditions of some of the old Bible patriarchs and prophets having glowing stones?
There are. And some traditions have it be the same stone. So, for example, Noah's stone book is passed down then from Noah to Abraham, for Abraham to Samuel and so on, down to prophets and wise men all the way through Solomon, then had other books, but this one is the one he liked best, they say.
So that's maybe what gave Solomon his wisdom?
Part of it. Solomon's okay. Got wisdom from all sorts of different sources, according to his legends. But the thing is, this stone, in some traditions, it's the same. In other traditions, these are different stones. So it's not always the same.
In the book of Abraham, like we read about Abraham's Urim and Thummim. So is that kind of the same type of glowing stone that we were talking about as far as the traditions say?
Right. In some traditions, it's the same one that's passed down. Some of them, they're unique to him. Mm-hmm. But there's one where he had a stone and he was able to see through it, mm-hmm. fill with light, but also it was able to heal people.
I've heard that.
And this is the same thing, like I mentioned earlier, lapis lazuli had healing treatments. This was considered a very legitimate part of religion. God hangs it on the sun when Abraham dies. So it doesn't go down to the others in that tradition.
Okay.
But there's a different tradition where Abraham passes his own stone down to Isaac.
Okay. So what happens after Isaac gets it? Does anybody know?
Yeah. So let me first share. This is one that I've only recently read and I don't think it's ever been brought up.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So there's another late 13th century Spanish work of Kabbalah, which is one of the mystical traditions later on. But they've got a bunch of discussion about Abraham and Isaac. There's a verse about the sons of the concubines, Abraham's other wives, getting some gifts by Isaac, getting everything.
Oh.
And this everything is supposed to be Abraham's glowing stone. And he gives it to Isaac as a reward for enduring through all the terrors of nearly being sacrificed. He tells him, I'm giving you this stone because I know that when you have Esau, he's going to spend all your money and waste all your resources. So you can use this stone to find other precious stones and wealth.
Oh.
So that's really interesting, especially when you think about later on Joseph Smith's early career.
Yeah.
And here, so we see that there's not a lot of condemnation. In fact, there isn't any. There are legitimate uses for it.
Okay, that kind of reminds me of the story of Jacob with his rod of poplars, where he was like touching the calves, and they were so he was using that for a secular thing too, in order to gain wealth and to be able to provide for his family and everything. So that is very interesting.
And Abraham in that text specifically talks about how this is stone with the divine light to help create all things.
That is very cool.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of things. And then there's traditions about Jacob with it. Jacob's a whole nother thing with his close association with the sun, which we see all the patriarchs are connected to the sun. And the sun's also connected to finding jewels and metal and gold and things. There's a whole lot in that. But I do want to go a little bit more about the divine light.
Yes, please.
Because so this tradition, God hides it. So the wicked can't use it. One strand of the tradition says it's hidden for the righteous, for the future world to come, which means that it's not available until the end of days. But there's so many others talking about how you can use it all the time. Abiezrael of Girona says that it was hidden for the righteous for the future. Not the future world to come, but for the future when they need to use it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's the light of prophecy, because you can see what's going to happen from one end of the world to the other, from beginning and back of time. And it's this divine light that is fused, it's hidden. It's usually believed to be hidden either in certain objects like mirrors or speculum or jewels. or it's hidden in books.
That's so interesting.
And there's this really lovely tradition, and I'll paraphrase what Martin Buber wrote about later. But the whole thing is the light lets you see, and it's a light of prophecy. And we have a much later 18th century tradition about the founder of the Hasidic music, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. And someone's cattle went missing. So he goes to find them. He pulls it up and he tells the guy, hey, I know where your cattle are. I found it written in the Zohar, and which is primary text of Jewish mysticism and esoteric. And the guy says, does he really say that exact description there? He says, no, but it's filled with the light. And I was able to see where your cattle are. In the same opportunity, I saw something that was going on in the Jewish community of Amsterdam. And they were both in the territory of Ukraine. His nephew says that he saw what's happening on with his brother-in-law in the land of Israel, also on a separate occasion.
So that is like Joseph Smith finding like the needle in the haystack, or the where he saw David Whitmer coming to visit him before.
Yeah, so we have this divine light being used to find cattle that went missing.
That is so interesting, the way it all ties together.
And it was through a book. In this case, the instrument is a book. In other cases, it's a stone.
Oh, that is so cool. And like the Book of Mormon is kind of both. I mean, it was in the stone box, and it was pulled out of the earth like a stone would be, but it's a book.
Right. And you've got a lot of that. It's the instrument is less important than what is actually happening, which is use of that divine light by the righteous.
So do you have any of these other connections that we haven't talked about yet? Any of these other stories that might fit into this theme?
Leviathan is one of these ancient traditions I mentioned earlier that survives, because we know that the earliest ancient Near Eastern myths, and we have this in the Bible, are about God vanquishing the monsters of chaos and banishing him to the ocean and other parts while he creates the land and puts order. And Leviathan survives. Leviathan, or the Tanin, which is crocodile or dragon, and look at Book of Abraham. That's a fun connection there. But anyway, there's one tradition in the Zohar where radiates light and carves light into the sun, which then people are able to use and find gold.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And there's a whole tradition in the Zohar about this, the ancients in the mountains of the East using rites of the sun at dawn with that light radiating, the first light, to be able to find where the gold is, which is considered idolatrous, not because it's false, but because they're taking part of the worship and distorting it, so they're focusing only on that.
But that also ties into the story of Joseph Smith too, where he's able to find gold, which is actually the light, because it's scriptures at the same time.
Right. And Joseph is versed in those secular, I mean, we couldn't even call it secular because the people at the time, there was as much of a spiritual dimension to this as it was for profit or greed. But Joseph takes his talent and his skills and his abilities and uses it according as God directs to find this more spiritual form of gold.
It is so cool the way it all ties together like that.
Yeah, it's...
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things we can look at.
You're kind of blowing my mind a little bit with all of this. That is so cool. Okay, I just have one or two more questions for you. But in a book called Seer's Stone versus Urim and Thummim, the Book of Mormon on Trial, James and Hannah Stoddard say this, quote, "The Lord works in repeating patterns, and as we can see, his pattern has remained consistent through generations of prophets and throughout time," end quote. They meant that to say that it was a critique of Joseph using seer stones that would have been ordained by God other than the Urim and Thummim. They were saying that it doesn't fit the Lord's patterns. And so it couldn't possibly be true that he was using these other seer stones. So how do you respond to that? Would you agree, or do you think it's actually the opposite? Like it fits the Lord's pattern better than just having just the Urim and Thummim?
I mean, once we accept that the Lord's going to use a glowing stone, right, or a stone that you can look into and see things with. Does a number of them make any difference, or where one comes from or not? Mm. It's not the instrument that really matters here. In fact, these are vessels for divine light,
right,
which is based on Joseph being righteous. Not just anyone can pick. I can guarantee if the church would ever let you pick up that seer stone, mm-hmm, it's not going to just work for you.
Right.
Joseph ends up using it because he's more used to it. It's the Urim and Thummim, the interpreter, is there, mm-hmm, spaced further out for him. It's cumbersome. He doesn't know how to use it.
Right,
so he does the same thing, but accomplishes the same purpose. And B.H. Roberts has in his New Witnesses for God, he has such an amazing description of its spiritual purpose and light. It's not something that bothered him. He didn't see it as a different pattern. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should be bothered whether it happens in a book, in a brass mirror, in a stone of whatever shape, size, or color, or provenance. Mm-hmm. Because some of these traditions we have, and we have other figures that, not just biblical ones that have them, mm-hmm, they don't usually care much about where they come from, but it's all about that divine light that comes through them and the purpose that they're used for. Joseph didn't persist in his village seer, treasure digging. Mm-hmm. He turned it to the purpose that God wanted him to use. So if you're going to have a faith crisis, that's not what it should be about, is which glowing stone you used.
Right.
Going off all of these examples, it seems like sometimes the Lord uses tangible objects to directly provide messages and lessons from God, such as the Liahona or the brass serpent. Other objects work more naturally in ways to help the prophet understand the revelation he's receiving, such as Jacob's rod or the apostles' lots or Joseph's of Egypt's divining cup. Seer stones, though, including the Nephite interpreters, seem to do both. Joseph Smith and other seers could look into them and see direct revelation, such as during the translation process. But according to Joseph's own words, over time he became more comfortable receiving revelations, and he stopped using the stones altogether. So they were essentially a learning tool to help teach him how to receive and understand revelation. Some critics say that Joseph was making it all up, and others say that the interpreters had to be the only tool used in the translation process. They say that the term Urim and Thummim was always defined as being the interpreters. Trained LDS historians, however, currently believe that the term Urim and Thummim meant all seer stones, and that the term was used interchangeably. So who's right? We're still at the very beginning of our investigation, and we have a long way to go before we can answer that question definitively. To me, though, right now, just looking over all of the different times the term is used across our scriptures, the colored gems on the ephod and breastplate in the Bible, the white stones bearing our new names in the celestial kingdom from the Doctrine and Covenants in Revelation, Abraham's glowing healing stone from the Book of Abraham, and the Nephite interpreters, it at least seems plausible that the seer stone could also be called the Urim and Thummim. It's at least a valid possibility that's worth discussing through later episodes. There's even a verse in the Book of Mormon, Alma 37:23, that talks about a prophet using a single stone that shines light out of the darkness that will help the Lord discover who his true followers are. I mean, what does that sound like to you guys? To me, it sounds a lot like the stories of Joseph using his personal seer stone and putting it into the darkness of the hat so he could better see the light. And what is the Book of Mormon but a sifting tool to help find those who will follow God? So it seems to me that the historians are right about that. But that's what we're here to investigate, and we all may come to a completely different conclusion by the time the series is over. When we take all of this into consideration, though, the question becomes, is this really from God, or is it just a lot of spin and nonsense? Or worse, is it actually evil and from the devil? That's the real question here. What tool Joseph uses to help him translate the Book of Mormon isn't a very big deal just by itself. But what it means for us as followers of Christ is a big deal. Because if Joseph was a lying fraud, that matters. If Joseph was deceived by the devil, that matters too. And if Joseph was truly a prophet of God, called to restore the fullness of the gospel of Christ to the earth, then that matters most of all.
So, clearly, from the exhaustive research you have done, Sarah, although Sarah and exhaustive research go hand in hand, so we have to give credit where credit is due on that one. But there is a clear theological foundation wherein we see God interacting through physical objects in the physical world. One might even say a rock hard foundation.
Zach!
You could also say seer stones rock.
Yes. Yes, they do.
You two are the worst.
We're amazing. You love our sense
I know.
Of humor.
You love us.
Sarah, you leave us with a question of like, what matters in all? Yes. And some of the questions maybe don't actually change. Like, did he use the seer stone to translate this particular word? Like, does that really change anything?
No.
And yet there is like this flexibility of some different opinions on the seer stone idea. Where do you personally fall? I know you know all the research. What do you think?
I think that he probably did use it for portions. I don't know which portions. I don't know how many portions, but I think he probably did use his personal seer stone for some portions. But ultimately, what I think is most important is that we aren't going to find that out just by reading and you know, even talking to experts, we're not going to find out exactly what was going on. So the only real way we can do that is to get on our knees and talk to God about it and just loop him into all of our questions and see what he says.
You're displaying this like comfort with the unknown. It doesn't all have to be completely logically locked down. You know enough. The parts you don't know, like you seem really comfortable with.
It took me a long time to get to the point to accept that there are going to be some things that I'm not going to figure out in this life, and I have to be okay with that. Because I like learning, and I like having answers, and I like knowing what things are. And it drives me nuts when I don't have those answers. So it took me a long time to learn to be okay with that.
I feel like Sarah, Zach is probably one of the smartest people that you and I know.
Yeah.
Probably smarter than both of us put together. And if a Sarah Allen can be okay, like not knowing everything, it makes me feel a little bit calmer of like, I don't have this 100% figured out, but there's enough.
That is way kinder than I deserve, but thank you.
Thoughts from you, Zach?
Well, yeah, you're right. I guess I have been a little quiet. I guess I at least for me personally, the way I see it is that God works in ways that we understand. And God is willing to kind of meet us where we're at. And I'm certainly grateful for that concept because I like the idea of God being able to understand where I'm at in life and still be able to help me do a little bit better every day. Help me to make other people's lives a little bit better.
It's a really good, helpful illustration because God deals with us differently at different points in our lives. We're treated differently as babies. Our responsibilities are different than they are as adults. And he sort of has seemed to do that throughout human history. He spoke to people in the Old Testament through ways they understood, but their understanding of the world was really different than ours. And so it's almost like we have to give them in their time the grace for God to talk to them as them, just like he led us as toddlers and preschoolers and children. He led them in a way. He leads us now as adults in a different way. He leads in our era in a different way. Sometimes speaks to us through different means, but he's still speaking.
I think that is a really excellent point. Just at work, I've actually been studying a lot of the differences between the way that God spoke to Abraham and ancient people. Compared to how he speaks to us today and in Joseph Smith's day and kind of comparing and contrasting all of those. And it's really interesting. Like you can see parallels, but there are some big differences too, because he does use their understanding of the world and their knowledge in order to teach them concepts that are eternal.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It really is.
Amen to that.
It actually ties really well into what the next episode will be, which I have taken on. Okay. How did people from the end of Bible times up until Joseph Smith's time, how did they understand like the physical world and of the folk magic beliefs that were in their world? Did that go away after Bible times? And then it just pops back up in Joseph Smith's time. It'll be really fun to get to talk with you guys about all of that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm excited
to see what you uncover.